Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, and welcome to episode 48 of the PreparedX Podcast. Before I get going, I just want to let you know that PreparedX will be sponsoring the International Crisis Management Conference again in Boston on April 25th of this year, 2018. We'll have a booth there. I'll be there as well as the team during the conference. So swing by the booth and say hello. Go to crisisconferences.com for more information. Again, crisisconferences.com for more information. We will be a gold sponsor again this year for the conference. Okay, on to the podcast, which is episode 48, and my interview with Chris Regan, who is the CEO of Cerastes Limited of the UK. I know Chris from the military days, so he's an old friend of mine. I think we've known each other for about 20 years now. My discussion with Chris was focused on his experiences with preparing organizations, both government organizations as well as corporations, for the physical and digital threats that they face, mainly around security practices. Much of our discussion was centered around how hostiles prepare their attacks, how they conduct surveillance both online as well as physical surveillance. So this one was really, really interesting. Again, here's my interview with Chris Regan, episode 48 of the PreparedX Podcast. Enjoy. Good morning, Chris. How are you doing today? And are you in the UK today?
Yes, I am in the UK, Rob. Yeah, I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good, good, good. As we do in all our interviews here, just before we get started, could you introduce yourself and just talk for a few minutes about your career to date, please?
Yeah, I'm Chris Regan. I'm the chief exec at a UK-based company called Cerastes. We do security assessments, but specifically from the hostile perspective. I sort of got into this. I spent 22 years in the British military, as you well know.
Yes.
With military intelligence there, and I spent probably roughly half my time in military intelligence as a security advisor, advising on how to fix security processes and protect our assets, and then the other half in the intelligence world trying to target other people's assets and catch them and target their people, their processes and their infrastructure. Did a bit of red teaming in the military and then ended up setting Cerastes up in 2012. Doing red team commercially now.
Great. So love to hear a little bit more as we go through this about Cerastes and the services. I think and you can provide some information at the end because our listeners will be really interested in what you guys get up to. But onto the interview, can you, as it relates to those some of those groups that are hostile to our organizations, be it a government organization or be it a corporation, you know, what kind of groups or individuals do organizations need to be aware of?
Well, it's a very personal thing, Most of the time, you've got to think really from your organization's point of view backwards. Who would want to target me? What's the threat to me? It's really personal. You can break it down in quite a dry way into different threats, subversion, espionage, terrorism. But really, each business should be looking about, which people are out there trying to cause you harm.
Right, right. And so, is that part of the kind of one of the first steps that an organization should take then is really looking and thinking about, what those groups, who those groups might be?
Yeah, it is. It's part of your sort of threat and risk assessment. And with hostiles, the reason we use the term hostiles is we're not talking about natural disasters or user error, which can cause a great deal of damage to the business. Those are all threats that most businesses will have on their threat analysis. But we're talking about people. That's why we're calling them hostiles. For whatever reason, people and organizations that are out there trying to cause people harm and thinking about how to succeed and conduct their attacks. So, yes, you do need to sit there and understand which people are out there who wish to cause your organization harm or may wish to do something else that still may impact on your business or your people.
Right, right. So, and this, so as it relates to information that's available to these hostiles now, be it a corporate website, you know, be it all these different social media outlets that where organizations are obviously trying to, you know, push out information to their consumers, you know, why can that information be used against the organizations?
Well, in all the hostile want to achieve is to have a successful attack, whatever that attack is, or successful action, if it's a protest group or something like that. They just want success. They want to achieve their aims. The more information that they've got, the more confident they're going to be that they can succeed in those aims. So the amount, the wealth of information that's available online helps them and supports that. There's vast amounts of detail available, not just on websites, but across the internet. But it's not always a bad thing. We can't hide behind that. Sometimes I think security professionals can look at the huge amount of information that's out there and just wish that they could redact it all and remove it. You can't do that for a start. We don't want to stop using information or really let information get out there. It's more a case of trying to look at that information and cut through it to find out which parts of it would be useful to a hostile, where the detail is. And quite often, some of the detail that's available is of no use to the public, to your normal users of that information. And the real detail that's available there can be useful to the hostile. I mean, social media is a massive one. Certainly when it comes to targeting people, if you're looking at social engineering, exploiting individuals in a business, social media is massive. There's a vast amount there. But it's all coming down to aggregating that data. An individual might have a LinkedIn profile. There's no problem with that. But when you look at every LinkedIn profile for that business, there can be a vast amount of information that becomes exploitable to the hostile. And of course, everyone has their work social media profile, but then they also have their personal social media profile, and then their family and friends have the same, and their colleagues from university and so on have that. And you can start picking up a really, really detailed picture of a person based on the aggregated data that is available about them, both work and personal, and on their whole network. It is big.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And obviously, you know, hostile probably has the time, right? So they want to make sure they've got the right data before they, you know, proceed. And when they do proceed, if it is some kind of physical event that they're planning, can you talk just, you know, for a few minutes about physical surveillance? Will they follow on that digital preparedness with some kind of physical surveillance of a location or individual?
Well, almost always, if the attack is going to have some form of physical presence during the attack, so if they're going to visit that location, then undoubtedly there will be physical reconnaissance as well. All they're trying to do is get confidence that their attack will succeed. And from the security professional's point of view, we don't give the hostile enough credit for the amount of the success that they need, the degree of success. They don't go out thinking they might succeed. They go out thinking that they're going to succeed. And they get that confidence from having answers to all of the questions they think they might face. Where am I going to go? What time will the target be there? What would happen if this happened? All of those questions, if they can't answer them online, they will go to the location to try and get that information. And that really doesn't make a difference regardless of the threat that you face. If you were going to do an attack and that you had to go to that location to do the attack, you would do a recce there yourself. Even if it's simply a walk past, trying to get some atmospherics of the location, how does it feel? It's all very well hearing what an organization's security is like online and seeing bits of video, maybe street view, but you have to go there yourself. You have to go and see it. You have to feel it. There's a big difference between seeing a physical asset and understanding the way it feels in that environment to see whether your attack will work.
Yeah, I think I heard something about the Nice attack with the truck that went down the boulevard there, that individual had either walked it or had been down there before to check out where, you know, his route was going to be with that attack. So, that you know, that certainly rings true there. Do you have some other examples of where either digital and physical surveillance were used in the planning stages that, you know, are fairly well-known examples?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few. I mean, Nice is one case in point. Yes, they walked out, you know, drove down there as well, and drove down beforehand. And they probably, in terms of the Nice attack as well, the truck that they used wasn't just chosen because it would do a great deal of damage. It also was there to make sure it could get up over the curbs because it was a pedestrianised area. You need to have walked that and looked at those points to have to be confident that that's going to work. However, the Nice attack, probably the recce for that might well have been done for by a few other people as well as just him.
Okay.
So I think the European attacks in that period were very well. The recce was done extremely well there, and for all of them. Case in point would be the Bataclan Theatre in Paris. The attackers that did the attack on the Bataclan had the floor plans of the Bataclan on their phones. So they had the detail before they went there that they'd got online. Now, not having the floor plans wouldn't necessarily turn that attack off, but it certainly gave them the confidence of where the attackers would go and how that they would approach that attack. Because, of course, as soon as they go through the door, that attack's on. And any attack where you're talking about taking on a large group of people. You don't know what the dynamic is going to be like once you get into that crowd. The crowd could turn on the shooters.
Yep.
And take them on. As it happens, I think they've seen the you know, YouTube videos of different concerts by that band and by at that theatre. So they had a little bit of an understanding of what they faced. They had the maps of the location, so they knew where they would be coming in. And they knew where the fire doors are. They knew where the exits would be. So they knew the crowd could get away from them, which was, I think, quite important to them. So much so that they put a shooter in the alleyway at the back to get people coming out of the fire escapes. That's not to say they didn't want them to come out. I think they did want them to try and escape. I just think they wanted to get them again when they tried to escape. You don't want the crowd to come on top of you.
Wow.
So that gives you quite a stack of the thought process that's going through the hostile when they're, you know, it's not just the case of turning up with a gun and shooting a crowd. It's thinking about every step of the way what will happen to make it succeed.
Yep.
Imagining it and almost fantasizing.
And so in your opinion, then, every attack is preceded by a period of surveillance, both digital and physical. Almost every attack.
Almost every attack. The thought, you know, when we hear about a lone wolf or someone who was radicalized very, very shortly and just went out and did something, more often than not, once the investigation starts taking place, you realize that there was some form of support network, even if it's just a moral support network online. And you also find out that this took place over a bit of a longer period of time, and they have been thinking about it. They have been fantasizing about it. This is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to do it. So there's always a degree of planning.
Yeah, we find the same over here in the States with, you know, the events that we have over here, the attacks that happen over here, be it a school shooting or some other kind of, you know, corporate active shooter type event. We always hear that those, you know, there were those signs coming into the event. And obviously from a planning standpoint, more often than not, the investigation happens and, you know, the individual was planning it for a period of time. So so that rings true, certainly, with those types of events as well. So let's talk a little bit about how the organization can, you know, reduce its exposure to these types of attacks.
Well, because the attack needs planning, you've got to really think about making your security systems a little bit more dynamic. It's a dynamic threat. If you build a lot of physical security around a location, the hostile will look at it and either go somewhere else or find a way through your security measures. So you have to have a security system in place and a security and culture, with security culture which is designed to try and catch and deter the hostile. It's a constant battle to do that. It isn't something that you can sit down and build a plan to protect yourself as a business and then put that plan in place and leave it. It has to be a constant active process. And really it comes down to vigilance. And that is a staff function, really. You can have all sorts of physical assets, but the most powerful thing you've got is high quality people in your business. The guards on access control, CCTV control rooms, whether it's concierge services and customer service, these people motivated, who look professional and are very vigilant, that's the absolute key. And if you can get them to sort of trust their gut feelings, to engage with people, talk with people, if they see something they think is a bit wrong, to say so and have a reporting structure in place, lower the threshold for their reporting and get them to be to report what they see. As you said yourself, in the after review of most of the attacks, there's endless occasions where people said, I thought something was wrong, I knew there was something there. And in hindsight, which is a wonderful thing, but in hindsight, there are always occasions where you could have intervened if you trusted your staff's vigilance and encouraged it as much as possible.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. It's funny, I was listening this morning to the radio on the way into work, and they were talking about West Ham United, the football club in London. They had an incident over the weekend, and they were talking about the amount of stewards that were at the stadium, and they had a pitch invasion, for those of you that don't know about the situation, and a number of people ran on the pitch, and there was, you know, a big gap in terms of the security. But the gentleman making the point, and he was a former player himself, he made the point that, look, you know, these individuals are running on the fields here, that, you know, they, I think one or two may have had flares with them, and, you know, they were protesting against the club ultimately because of various other reasons, but they really struggled. The staff at the stadium struggled to control the situation. And he made a good point that, you know, look, they're on minimum wage. They probably don't get paid to handle, that many individuals running onto the field. And, why would they on minimum wage want to do that? But it opened up a huge gap in this particular stadium and this football club's security. And it was certainly a good discussion this morning. And he made the point, one person made the point that, it may have been a flare this time, but what if next time it was something else? And so I think there's a number of football clubs throughout Europe, not just the UK, this morning looking at that situation saying, could that happen to us?
Yeah, definitely. It's quality of your staff. We spend a lot of time spending money on building processes and policies, which are all necessary. And we spent a great deal of money on physical hard assets for security. And we definitely don't resource the most powerful asset that we own, which is our staff.
People.
Not just the security staff, but also selling security to your wider business, to all of the other people in your business, so that it's not seen always as a handbrake to growth. It's a pain for people that we have to have security processes. If you sell it properly to them, and explain why you're doing things and how you're doing things, you can actually get people to be a little bit more involved as well. And that hardens the environment against the hostile as well. But really, it's all to do with people. If our people are good, it's a hard environment for the hostile to operate in.
Yeah, I hear that as well. We talk about that in crisis management here with our clients as well. Your number one stakeholder is your employee. And then we talk about it from a branding, you know, reputation and protection standpoint, but we also talk about it as, you know, they're on the front line. So, you know, if you want something to be reduced in terms of the risk or the threat to the organization, you know, you need to arm those individuals. And you want them to be your advocate, right? That you want them to be able to obviously say, I am ready, I am prepared if anybody asks, versus, you know, not being communicated to with regards to whether it's security or crisis preparedness. So that's really good to hear you say that, because we have the same point of view from a crisis management standpoint. So can you talk for, as you know, here at PreparedX, we're all about security exercises, crisis management exercises, you know, preparing organizations through these either tabletop or other types of exercises. Can you talk for a few minutes from your standpoint the importance of running either a red teaming exercise, and could you explain that, or other exercises to validate security response planning?
Well, simply, the first thing with any exercise like that is because you really want to know whether the system that you've built works and works in reality. It might look very good normal day to day. You might have planned for all of the eventualities on paper, but really you want to know whether your system's going to work, how it will work in reality, what happens when things start to go wrong or when an incident happens. So that's the first part, is does it work? I mean, if you don't go out and have some form of validation exercise which takes place in reality, then the only other metric you're going to have is history. It's never happened before, so we must be doing something right. Now, you might get away with that for some time, you know. In the case that we're looking at with terrorism, and for an awful lot of your exercises as well, you might be talking about something which is very low likelihood. They've built systems to make sure mistakes don't happen, that natural disasters are very unlikely to affect the process. In our case, it's terrorism. It's unlikely to come to your doorstep. However much we hear it on the news, it's very unlikely to happen in your location. But just because it's low likelihood, the impact can be massive. It can be huge. And so we've got to make sure that the system in place can cope with that. If it does happen, what would happen? And of course, running exercises, especially red teaming is done quite often in order to keep people on their toes. If we talk about vigilance being important, if we need people to be able to do a job regularly, but that they may never see hostile reconnaissance. You know, you could be a security guard and be told to look for hostile reconnaissance and been working in that business for 8-10 years and never having seen it.
Right.
The likelihood of seeing that incident and responding to it appropriately, having that professional curiosity and vigilance when it's only happened 5 minutes in 10 years of your career is pretty low.
Right.
So because these things don't happen all the time, they have to be exercised, and they should be exercised as close to reality as possible. So rather than creating an environment where we all sit down and say, this is what's happening, what would happen, you try to generate that scenario based validation. Try to make it as real as possible. Try to apply the stresses that would be in place. And there's a difference in terms of red teaming. That's the difference between a simple test where you make a penetration test on access control, see whether a contraband item can get through a scanner.
Yep.
That's a simple test. Is the scanner working? Is the person trained to the right level, and are they vigilant? It's got its value. It's a compliance test, and it's very useful. The red teaming process should allow the whole of the hostile action to be replicated, so all of their planning. And then you would only do the red teaming options, the attack options that are realistic. And you'll be able to sit there and say, well, I wouldn't do that attack because I don't think I'd succeed, or so on and so on. It's making things realistic because you want the security system to work in reality. That's the point of validation.
Right. Yep, makes total sense. Appreciate that. Well, this was an excellent episode today. I want to thank you for taking the time out for doing this, Chris. Any final comments for our listeners? And if they want to contact you, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, contact us through the website, really. It's serastes.co.uk, UK-based company, so it's got the co.uk at the end. As for final comments, all I would say, really, is that it's not as easy being a hostile as many security professionals think. They're under pressure to succeed. They really are. There's an awful lot going on. They need to have a successful attack. That's what they want. That's their desire. They can't just do anything or be anywhere at any time. Their need to succeed means that they are predictable. And all of the work that we do can influence them significantly. Instead, their job isn't as easy as we think it is. All we've got to do is just make it harder.
Perfect, perfect. Again, thanks for your time today, Chris, and we'll touch base again soon.
Cheers, Rob. Thank you very much.
Yeah, take care. Cheers, mate. Bye. That's it for episode 48 of the PreparedX podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your audience. And don't forget, please rate us on iTunes. It's really important. Write something in there. Let us know what you like. If you want some more of a particular subject, but it's really important, just go to iTunes or any of the other distribution channels and make a comment. Appreciate the feedback. Until next time, goodbye.